From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Many of the great breakthroughs in science ran counter to the popular thoughts of the day, and in some cases, it took years before the lessons of these discoveries were understood and could be applied to other areas of our lives. Margaret Wheatley is an associate professor of management at Brigham Young University. She is the author of the book Leadership and the New Science. Her personal breakthrough came when she realized that the concepts of quantum mechanics and chaos can help us to better understand how human organizations work. I'll also speak with Dr. Bernhard Heisch. He is an astrophysicist and a member of the Society for Scientific Exploration. The Society binds respected professors and researchers throughout the world to support the investigation of phenomenon which is not examined by mainstream science. We'll talk about the difficulties of performing research in these areas. Margaret Wheatley's book, Leadership and the New Science, Learning About Organization from an Orderly Universe, takes a different view of organizations and the people in them. She began by describing just what is the new science.
The new science is a new way of looking at things. It's one of the basic shifts that scientists have made, partly because we can now observe 43 times more than we used to be able to with our naked eye, observe more of the universe. Scientists are now seeing things more in terms of wholes and looking for patterns of connections, networks. They're more interested in looking how things work together. This is a radical departure from looking at the world as a great clockwork machine, which was the 300-year-old legacy we've had from Sir Isaac Newton's time. And so all of the new sciences, which include many different sciences of biology, chemistry, and physics, tend to, at a start, look for the whole of something and then try and understand the parts in terms of their relationship to the whole. That's the main distinction. There are others, but that's the really important one.
What is there to learn about organizations from understanding the new science?
Well, one of the interesting things is to realize how dominated our thinking about organizations is by the 17th century machine imagery. We have created in our minds the idea that organizations are well-oiled machines. And so we talk about tools and techniques and technologies, and we use a lot of machine imagery. Even more important than that, we have broken organizations into parts, and with the belief that if you have all of the right parts and you engineer it correctly, those things will work flawlessly. So we broke work into functions, we broke people into roles, we only wanted parts of people in the workplace. It's a very dominant imagery that once you start looking for it, you see everywhere. You see it in your language and you see it in the shape of whatever organization you're working in. What the new science is suggesting, which has also been suggested by people in other disciplines as well, is that let's think about organizations as living dynamic systems. Let's think of them as organisms rather than as machines and see what kind of new awareness and that would create and what kind of things seem important once you start looking at organizations as living systems rather than as complex, complicated, clanking machines.
When I read your book, I think one message that I got was sort of to let go of imposing a model of how organizations work, allow the organization to work, perhaps observe its unique elements and its relation and dynamic, and then perhaps only intervene as necessary.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's not quite as laissez-faire as that, but I think the big switch that any of us who are leaders, whether leaders of ourselves, our teams, or our organizations, have to make is to realize there's a huge difference between control and order. And the new sciences are showing us that, as one complexity scientist, Stuart Kaufman, said, in this universe you get order for free. So the question that I was asking in the book is, how can we make use of order that's available rather than control, which is something we impose? We have spent hundreds of years, and in the past few years we're getting better and better, at thinking that the only thing that makes an organization work is our imposition of a structure and our sense of controlling everything, having our hands on everything. What the newer science is saying is that there are processes available in natural living systems that lead to emergent order, so that if you bring people together, if you connect them together, if they have a clarity of shared purpose, they will structure themselves in ways that work best. That's not really just letting go and letting order emerge, because as a leader, it's really important to make sure that people are brought together and that people are focused on a clear sense of defining their shared purpose. But the actual structure that emerges, I believe, should be a consequence of what those people feel works best, and that structure will change. We're starting to talk about much more fluid organizational structures, things that will come and go and that will be determined by the work that needs to get done and people's perception of what the real needs are. So that's a fundamental shift from control to order, an order that's found all around us in a lot of natural processes.
You talk about the Newtonian quest for predictability, and certainly every project manager, anyone who has had to meet a hard deadline in a complicated project, is constantly pressured to predict and control what's going to happen. And given that we still have our same old jobs, how do we meld this concept into the facts of today?
Well, I think the place we need to start is a shared recognition that prediction doesn't work. I mean, it's the source of enormous frustration and a lot of wasted activity. I don't know how many organizations, having created a 5-year plan, strategic plan, ever satisfactorily reached that plan because the environment changed around them or beneath them. We live in a world in which it is not possible to project direct cause and effect. If I do this, then that will happen. That's not the world that we experience, and yet we're sort of struggling with all of these very old planning models, which are based on a simple world and on cause and effect relationships that in fact just haven't held up in reality. So the first place to start, I think, is in recognizing our failures at prediction and control. And then the next place to go with that is to think together, okay, what's the best we can hope for? We're moving into a universe that scientists define as probabilistic. We can work with probabilities, but we have to get out of this belief or this need for certainty, because it is a very uncertain world which we inhabit. All of the turbulence, all of the chaos of the business environment these days is just pressing in on us, and for anyone to hold on to the belief that they can somehow understand that business environment enough to control it, enough to plan real consequences from certain activities, real cause and effect relationships, that is it's a fantasy world to stay in those beliefs. And certainly as I go around talking to people, no one really believes in prediction anymore. We are still, as workers and employees, belaboring under these older models. There is much more interest in looking for models that deal with uncertainty, models that are probabilistic. Somebody said to me yesterday, you know, long-range planning in the U.S. now is 90 days. That's as far out as we can look. Well, there's something very true about that. So we are learning now, and there are a lot of theoreticians at work, how do you do strategic planning? What's the value of strategic planning in a world where you can't predict everything? And I think this is work that's just beginning, but it's clearly our future.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Margaret Wheatley. She's an associate professor of management at Brigham Young University and author of the book Leadership and the New Science. Now, Meg, you gave a list of changes in your book, changes in your own methods since coming to have an understanding of the new science. One of those changes is that you said you no longer argue with anyone about what is real.
Yeah, well, this is based on a much deeper Newtonian movement from Newtonian physics to what I call a quantum sensibility. One of the great discoveries at the level of subatomic particles is that any time we go to observe reality, we interfere with it, and that it's impossible to observe something independent of our acts of observing it. Every act of observation creates a disturbance, but we can never really know what's, quote, out there. And some people have taken this in a sort of postmodern sensibility to talk about that reality is something that we can never know except through our perception, and therefore it will always be particular to us. It's interesting to apply that to organizations because we spend inordinate amounts of time in organizations believing that we're right and someone else is wrong. We spend a lot of time in meetings trying to argue or persuade people that our perception is more correct than theirs, is more real than theirs. We hire experts who come in because we believe they have refined their perceptions and will give us the real information about what reality is. This is tricky stuff. I think the place for us to move organizationally is to stop arguing about what's right or what's real and instead get into conversations about what works. There are things that clearly work better at one time or another in our environments, and those are the things we want to be discussing, not arguing from a position that my belief or my perception is more correct than yours, but my belief or perception may be more applicable to current realities. And it's interesting because I often ask people in organizations, what would your life be like if you stopped arguing about who's right and who's wrong? And people tend to laugh. They start to realize how much of their time is spent in those kinds of discussions. If we can work collegially together to find out what works best right now for our organizations, I think it would really change a lot of the dynamics that are troubling us.
There's a quote in your book from Eric Jansch: to live in an evolutionary spirit means to engage with full ambition and without any reserve in the structure of the present, and yet to go and flow into a new structure when the right time has come. Having enthusiastically done this from time to time, I have received great criticism or sense tremendous irritation and blockage from the people who are trying to keep the current structure in place. Is that something that we can expect?
Yes. Absolutely.
On to the next one.
We are, this state that Jansch describes has a new name. It's called the edge of chaos. It's that delicate balance between having a sense of who you are and what structure works, balanced with being open to change and being open to new information that will cause you to change. I find that we come ourselves out of 300 years of wanting prediction, wanting certainty. We don't want to be in this fluid, evolving state. We want to know what we're going to be like or what someone else is going to be like today, tomorrow, and forever. So it's a very uncomfortable place, this edge of chaos, and yet it's creeping up all around us, the sense that we live on the edge. People use surfing analogies now or skiing analogies. One critic of what he called postmodern times said, you know, this isn't the age of anxiety, it's the age of edginess. And we're all on this edge, and we don't like it. We don't like it individually. People around us certainly don't like it when we get into our fluid, willing to change and be unpredictable mode. So I think we just have to expect that.
So perhaps Apple should rethink its name for its new computer, a Newton.
Well, that's a good point. Isn't it? Yes, well, we're still looking for certainty. I guess Apple would love a little more certainty in their market. So that's how they're getting it. They're naming their product Newton.
That's right. That direct wish.
That's right.
Well, just when we'd all gotten used to the idea that there could be chaos in the universe, you really kind of said there wasn't any chaos, only that which we were not yet able to observe its order.
Yes. Now, this, of course, you can approach from many centuries, thousands of years of spiritual wisdom, that there is a deep order to the universe. The science now is particularly the science of chaos, has looked at whole categories of chaotic systems and said that when you observe them over time and in a new kind of visualization where you can look at many variables at once and you can model the system in three dimensions, what you find is that from moment to moment, a system in chaos is unpredictable. That's the definition of a chaotic system. You can't predict what will happen next. So we still have that moment-to-moment feeling of craziness and unpredictability. But when you look at the behavior of that system over its evolution, over long moments of time, what scientists observe is that the system conforms to a boundary. It has a, its behavior has a shape to it, and its behavior never wanders outside of the boundaries of the shape. So you can predict the shape, but you can't predict individual moments. This is a has led to a new definition that chaos is order without predictability, which is a very paradoxical concept for us. We have always thought that order was something we created through our ability to control events or to control people or to control their behavior. What the science of chaos is suggesting to us is that you can have order without prediction. I believe at the level of leadership, what that leads us into is a paradoxical inquiry into the question of what should we be managing, what should we hold ourselves accountable for, but what could we let go of? If organizations have the same capacity to move chaotically at the level of individuals so that no two behaviors look the same, but that over time the organization still has a predictable shape to it, that would lead us to a very different way of managing. We would stop managing for compliance around behaviors. We'd stop having policies that dictate what people need to do in every situation. And instead, we think about how do we structure in this boundary for people, but then allow them to sort of wander within the boundary with their own autonomy. And I think these are very paradoxical and perplexing things to think about. I think they're also extremely important.
Part of the process of science is observing something you don't yet understand and getting comfortable knowing that you will see that phenomenon again and again. And perhaps that applies here as well. The point being that it's hard to think about letting people operate autonomously within this area,
right?
And because it doesn't really make a lot of sense to how we've been doing it. But if we can know at some level that it will work, then we can go ahead and do it.
Yes, and there are companies that are doing it, and there have been teams that have done it. We do have a lot of experiential data out there, but we haven't had the lens to look at it. We have, I think, a decent number of companies who've made a significant shift, and the shift is simply a realization that the people who work for them are adults. And as adults, they're able to deal with complexity, they're able to deal with ambiguity, they're able to make intelligent decisions, they're able to work in with a desire to improve the health and viability of the organization. And that if you really treat people as adults, then you quickly create much more autonomy for them. I mean, you trust them at a whole different level, and you don't have to legislate or mandate their behavior and their reactions from moment to moment. So some of this is merely deciding to look for the experiential data that's already there. I also, though, I agree with you, Moira, that I've certainly found that until leaders learn to see that people can be trusted as adults and therefore can be let go of being managed moment to moment, until they have that experience, this sounds incredibly fearful to them. This feels like a total loss of control. One of the things that has to switch in our thinking is our belief, our trust, our faith that in fact order is available without hands-on control. I think that's the fundamental shift in this paradigm shift we keep thinking about or talking about. Is this a well-ordered universe we live in? I believe it shows evidence of that everywhere. It gets along quite well without our interference. Gets along better without our interference, some would say. So the nature of the belief shift that has to occur is, I think, this shift from things fall apart without my interference, which is the old paradigm, to things work well, order can emerge, and I need, as a leader, to learn how to foster the processes, how to create the processes that allow this order to emerge. And that is such a departure from our 300 years of prevalent Western thought that I know this is not easy for people. I've watched myself struggle with it and realize that as much as I know about the science or about order for free, that actually allowing a group to stay in chaos as a way of coming up with more creative solutions, that was a very fearsome experience for me for many months. It isn't now, because I've seen that chaos can lead to much greater levels of creativity in a group, but it took me a while to make the switch from what I knew to what I was able to trust. And so I think that this is something that's going to take many years for leaders to come to grips with.
My guest today is Margaret Wheatley. She's president of the Burkana Institute and a consultant in management issues. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Meg, you talk about self-organizing systems in the book. Tell us about that.
Well, self-organizing systems are this wonderful discovery in new science that won the Nobel Prize for Ilya Prigogine in the late 1970s. We have always believed that systems, when confronted with change, fall apart, that the only prospect for them is death and deterioration, a sort of wearing down and giving up of their energy. What self-organizing systems as a category of systems have shown us is that living systems, this includes human beings, when confronted with enormous amounts of change, will fall apart. But if you watch them, when they reach that point of falling apart, they have two choices available to them, not one. The first choice is they can disappear and die. That's what we thought was the only choice. The second great revelatory choice available to them is that they possess an innate capacity to reorganize themselves so that they are better suited for the environment which has caused the change. Now, the interesting thing about self-organization as a model for organizations is it says that in order to get an organization to change, to adapt, to transform itself to a turbulent environment, that the organization needs to take in enormous amounts of information about what's going on in the environment, and that there may come a point when the information is so overwhelming to that organization that it can no longer maintain its present form. It can no longer work with its present structure, and then it will need to fall apart. It will need to plunge into a state of confusion or overwhelmness that I call chaos at the organizational level. And in that chaos, in that state of pure uncertainty, kicks in the self-organizing process. And what is then available through that chaos is a whole new order to the organization. The organization can reorganize itself so that it's much better suited to this environment which has shifted around it. Now, you can't get, this is the tricky part, you can't get to these adaptive and resilient and constantly changing organizations, ones that can really thrive in a chaotic external environment. You can't get those kinds of organizations unless you are willing to allow the organization or the team or yourself as an individual to periodically plunge into chaos. This is not something we value these days in management. Anytime we experience chaos, I think at the level of ourselves, our teams, or our organizations, we panic and believe that something has gone horribly wrong and that we better rush in there and save the group or ourselves or the organization from this confusion. So we try and structure ourselves out of chaos as quickly as possible. And what self-organization is saying, that when you structure yourself away from chaos, you prohibit the creativity that's available in the organization from surfacing. You actually prohibit the organization from coming to a solution that would be much better than the solution you have just structured in. I'm a real advocate these days for allowing chaos occasionally and at important moments to be present in our organizations to support people in their confusion rather than in their certainty. Bert Nanus, who wrote The Leader's Edge, said, in these times, if you're not confused, you're not thinking clearly. And I think that's a great motto we all should adopt. We have to realize that out of our confusion can come our best creative ideas. And that's the self-organizing organization, which I think people will hear more and more about in the next few years, works with chaos rather than trying to block it. It works with superfluous amounts of information rather than trying to control information. It works with natural ordering processes rather than saying, okay, here is the one best structure and this is how we're going to structure ourselves and then, oh, by the way, we've got to reorganize in 18 months because that structure didn't work. As we try and get these more fluid, adaptive organizations, we have to allow these self-organizing processes to kick in. And that means a very different use of information and a very different tolerance for chaos from time to time.
Another science concept which you talked about was fields. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the great understandings that has come to us in the 20th century from quantum physics is that space is not empty. In fact, it's filled with fields of energy. And I think this is an intriguing concept for organizations to think about what is the space of the organization and what's in it. If space is not empty, then we do possess the capacity to pick up what's in the field. Let's talk about the field of an organization for a moment. I believe the field of an organization is filled with messages about what gets rewarded here. What works here. If you want to succeed, this is what you need to be or how you need to behave or who you need to avoid. People pick up this information without even knowing it. And I believe that a lot of the inconsistencies or incongruencies in organizations, all of the things that get put under the current slogan of do we walk our talk or not, are feelings that people are picking up, a dissonance between what's written or put up on the walls of the organization and what they pick up from the field of the organization, which is this rich information that's out there about what's really real here, what gets rewarded. And there are some organizations who've contacted me who have felt that through very consistent and clear values that they have created a field of congruency that if people tune in, and we still don't know how we do this, if we tune into the field, we would pick up the same messages as are written in the value statement that's framed on the wall. And I believe that's a model for the kind of congruence we need to achieve in organizations. Once you have this field of information that is congruent with what you say you want to be, I think it's much easier for people to do what's necessary, to do what's right for that organization. They don't need as much training. Somewhere they are picking up this information without ever having learned it in our traditional linear fashion. And so it's an intriguing concept to me, and I've been intrigued by the organizations that have written to me or talked to me about the quality of the field they feel they have in place there.
Meg, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Maura.
My guest today has been Margaret Wheatley. She's author of Leadership and the New Science, Learning About Organization from an Orderly Universe. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology.
Dr. Bernhard Heisch is managing editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, a publication which examines non-mainstream science. One difficulty in pursuing such science is that the scientist must work in the face of negative popular opinion. I was reminded of the experience of Galileo, who caused quite a stir when he suggested that the Earth revolved around the Sun. I asked Dr. Heisch to recount that for us.
Well, in 1610, Galileo turned his telescope on Jupiter and discovered four moons, which we now know as Io, Callisto, Ganymede, and Europa. And by doing so, it's said that he threw off the stranglehold of Aristotelian astronomy. This is a story that's pretty familiar to me since I'm an astronomer myself. Now, we all know that he invited high-ranking churchmen to come look through his telescope, and in fact, what do? They refuse to look. So if this were an astronomy lecture now, I would probably encourage the students to chuckle and groan about the closed-mindedness of the prelates of the 17th century. But, you know, I don't think it's really as simple as that. Why did the prelates not look? This was something that I got a rather different reading on a few years ago when I read a book by Professor Paul Feyerabend and a philosopher of science up at UC Berkeley. Now, if you put yourself in the, whatever they wore, satin slippers maybe, of the cardinals of the 17th century, there are some things you should keep in mind. First of all, the crude telescopes of that day had lots of optical artifacts, which are well known to any modern astronomer, so you couldn't really believe what you were seeing through the telescope even here on the ground in the terrestrial realm. More importantly, there were good reasons based on Aristotelian physics to believe that there were two laws of nature, one law that operated here in the terrestrial realm and a very different one in the celestial sphere. So even if you saw something, there were good reasons to believe that what you were seeing might perhaps not be reality. So the cardinals were really not acting just out of closed-mindedness and thick-headedness. They were really being consistent with the belief system of their time. So this is an angle that I hadn't been aware of in the Galileo story. And this then brings me to wondering, well, who are the Galileos and who are the churchmen of today? And of course, most of us scientists like to think of ourselves as the Galileos. But you know, when it comes to investigating anomalies or to opening ourselves to phenomena that don't fit into our preconceived notions, I'm afraid sometimes we wind up being the prelates of the 20th century and not the Galileos. And that's why we have the Journal of Scientific Exploration.
Well, tell us about the journal and the society attached to it.
The journal really goes back to 1977. It hasn't been published that long, but it grew out of a survey that Professor Peter Sturrock, a professor at Stanford University, an astronomer, a survey that he did of members of the American Astronomical Society to see what their attitudes, what their belief, what their experiences were in the field of UFOs back in 1977. And he came up with the result that there was probably considerably more interest, probably more experiences that the astronomers were willing to report in the confidential survey than they were willing to talk about in public. So this raised the whole question of what do you do if you want to investigate a phenomenon or report a phenomenon and do it in the rational scientific way that we as modern scientists want to use? What do you do if there's no place to publish your results, if there's no place to present your data and have your colleagues critique it? So this led to, ultimately, to the formation of a Society for Scientific Exploration, whose goal was to establish a research journal. The society was founded in 1981. It had its first meeting in the Academy of Sciences building in Washington, and it took some 6 years to finally get the journal off the ground. And the journal is now the main research product of the society.
What kind of scientific phenomena are apparent, but they aren't generally pursued by the mainstream science?
Well, there are all sorts of anomalies, ranging from anomalies within mainstream science, things, for example, like quantized redshifts, to phenomena that are totally outside of the corpus of scientific knowledge, things like parapsychology, things like ball lightning, things like UFOs. And many of these things, unfortunately, have acquired a very bad reputation because there are people out there that make money off of these things. There are lots of unsubstantiated claims. But there also is perhaps some real data there, some real observations, perhaps even some real phenomena there. And we'll never know if we don't look at these phenomena look at these reports in the same way that we would any other scientific evidence.
Who can become a member of the Society?
To become a full-fledged member of the Society, you pretty much have to be a mainstream researcher. That is, you have to be someone who has established a reputation, publishes papers in a mainstream area of science. For example, we happen to have a lot of astronomers in the Society. We have physicists, we have now medical doctors. So you have to have a mainstream credential, a mainstream research activity that you pursue successfully. We have opened the Society recently to associates because we realize that there are lots of other very intelligent people around who are not mainstream scientists, so we've created a category of associates. But the journal is now available to anyone. The journal is available by subscription to anyone whatsoever, and we're hoping to make the journal not only reach a larger audience, but to give us a better vehicle for presenting data and scientific analysis of phenomena to the public at large. And so anyone who wants a journal can call Stanford University or write to Stanford University and subscribe to the journal. There's no restriction on that.
To publish in the journal, are these all members of the Society?
Not necessarily. The criteria for publication in the journal are basically the same as in any mainstream journal. You have to have a certain level of scholarship. We have the paper sent out for review by referees, generally two referees, and they have to pass the muster of referees. The basic philosophy is that we don't exclude any topic at all, but whatever topic is the subject of a paper has to be presented and done in the same scholarly way that would have to if it were going into a mainstream physics or astronomy journal.
One of the difficulties of refereeing such a journal and developing such a journal is since everything can be included, you're talking about a really broad base of science that can go on here. Isn't it difficult getting that refereed?
It is very difficult getting this refereed. Refereeing is something I'm familiar with because, in fact, I'm an associate editor of a mainstream science journal, and so I know how to go about doing this. Now, it's a little more difficult here because we are open to any topic, and there are things that come in that I know nothing about. I do a first screening just to see whether the paper is worthy of sending out for review, and there are certainly things that we get that never make it past that point. They get returned to the author or appropriately filed away. But articles that do seem to meet the scholarly criteria I would expect, I then have to find referees. And usually I look to members of the Society who have identified their areas of, both areas of expertise and areas of interest, because the two may not necessarily be the same. But sometimes I simply go to a mainstream journal like Science or Nature and find someone who's published something that is cited in the paper and send it out to them. And sometimes I will get back a report saying, well, I just can't believe anything like this. How did you get my name? Because they're mainstream researchers surprised to suddenly find a paper like this on their desks. Other times we get reviews from mainstream scientists that just treat the paper as they would any other paper coming from a mainstream journal. You can never tell.
How do you find someone, for instance, to referee an article on, say, reincarnation?
Well, there are people who have done research in this field, and I will look at the bibliography, obviously, of the paper. There are people who have done things in related fields, like near-death experiences. I remember in one case, I just found an anthropologist, because I thought that someone investigating myths, legends, folklore, I think that's what anthropologists do. I may be expressing some ignorance here because I'm an astronomer, not an anthropologist. But I went to an anthropologist at a university in California and got a very in-depth review, and that worked quite well.
I must tell you that I mentioned to one of the scientific guests on this show my familiarity with the Society for Scientific Exploration, and he could not have known that I had just spoken with two of your members. One was a dean emeritus of engineering at Princeton University, and another was another respected professor at Stanford University. And while this fellow's credentials were nowhere near as impressive as these other members of the Society, he said, oh, them, they just want to believe all sorts of things. Is this a reaction that's pretty typical?
I don't know if there is any one typical reaction. It ranges all the way from, oh, it's wonderful that there is a way to investigate these things scientifically, to, What are you doing wasting your time on that? Oh, my God, I could never believe these sorts of things. And it's not a matter of belief. I mean, I myself don't necessarily believe the things that are in the journal. I shouldn't as editor. I am there to make sure that only things of a proper caliber of scholarship can be published. And it's just not a matter of belief at all. In fact, we publish things that both claim the reality of a phenomenon and things that debunk. We're doing a great article in a few months, or at least have a paper that's passed the review process now, that essentially debunks a rather long-standing, very interesting but mythical story in the field of, I guess I would say, UFOs. It's kind of in an odd area, but it certainly has made the rounds of many of these conferences, and we're publishing an article that exposes this as basically a hoax.
So it's not simply a matter of trying to confirm the sort of the fringe elements of science. Sometimes those things out there which sound very attractive, you can take a look at and say, wait a minute, there really isn't anything here.
Indeed. Many times that's the conclusion we come to, and I think that's one of the most valuable services that we can perform to provide a way to demonstrate to the public that issues that are often of concern to them can be and are being investigated, and sometimes there's evidence for them and sometimes there isn't. But the only way to do this is to look at phenomena as we would any other phenomenon, and rationally and with hard noses look at it and see what's there.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Bernhard Heisch. He's an astrophysicist and the managing editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. One thing I've always felt was unproductive, but I have witnessed in academia and in research and at NASA and at many places I've been, is a habit of displaying public contempt for people who don't agree with you. Not you, but we'll see certain professors and researchers do that. We recently spoke with Dr. Edward Teller, and that interview won't air for a while, but he said very poignantly that Enrico Fermi had counseled him vehemently against working on the hydrogen bomb. And what Teller said was that he was immensely grateful to Fermi because after Teller went ahead and led that effort, Fermi remained his friend. What happens within your society when people disagree? Do people really get that excited?
When people disagree, well, we have conferences. We have annual conferences. And clearly, looking around at the audience, I can see that the reaction of some people is, oh, I don't believe this at all. How did this get on the agenda? To, oh, this is very interesting. I want to hear more about this. We don't have fist fights. we probably have the same kinds of disagreements that you would have at an astronomy conference, where people are on opposite sides of a given theory or a given hypothesis. It really looks a lot like any other professional conference when you go to one of our meetings. And I think our journal looks very much like any other kind of journal. And in fact, we encourage discussion and debate. One thing that we do in the journal, now that you mention controversy, one thing that we do that most mainstream journals don't is to, in some cases, publish a critical referees report, a signed critical referees report following an article. If I think, as editor, and perhaps one of the referees thinks that an article has merit and the second referee does not, then to put these things before our colleagues so that further investigation is possible, we sometimes publish the article along with the critical referees report, in which the referee is free to say, I don't believe this, I think this is done poorly, this should be improved, this is all wrong, and the author can respond to that. And the purpose is to put these things out there, not for us to pontificate, for us to make decisions, but to put these things out for our colleagues to have the evidence so that sometime in the future we can come back to this again and maybe make a little more progress.
Now let's talk some specifics. I think a lot of people haven't heard about ball lightning. Tell us about that.
Well, ball lightning is not a topic I know a great deal about. We have had, I believe, one or two papers on it. In fact, the papers that we had on ball lightning were mainly of phenomenology. We published an article of reports going back to the 19th century by two or three Russian scientists from Yaroslavl University. And I have met a ball lightning researcher in Budapest. I really have no feeling one way or the other whether ball lightning is real, but I have seen some evidence and some reports that at least would suggest to me it's worthy of investigation, that there is possibly something here that we should look at. I don't know whether it's real or not.
But what is it? I mean, are we talking about lightning that doesn't look like it zigzags across the sky?
Okay, I remind you, I'm not an expert on this, but it's apparently a ball of flaming something or other that exists as that can exist for several seconds, perhaps several minutes. I think I've heard reports of it entering an aircraft and sort of floating down through the cockpit or entering a house. I have seen videotapes of a house in which it's claimed ball lightning has, so to speak, roamed around, and seen on the video walls and the floor being severely displaced as if there was some enormous electrostatic force. But whether this is a electrical phenomenon, whether it's some kind of ionization of gases, I really have no idea.
So I can imagine someone witnessing something like this and coming away and going, I saw it, and everyone saying, what did you see? What could this mean? So I can see where that would be something that, since you couldn't really reproduce it, would be a difficult thing to talk about, and, you know, legends could come up around it.
It is, yes. Well, not all of our articles in the journal are necessarily research on a given topic. We did one recently, for example, that I think would be really useful for any teacher, and that is an overview of the UFO literature. Now, there's no original research in the article at all, but it's a very well-done compendium of sources and discussion of the sources and ranking of the sources and grouping of the sources, so that if someone were in a position of teaching a freshman class on UFOs or some other area of anomalies in science, at least in this particular field of UFOs, this would be the article to go to. It was written by a professor at the Western Michigan University, and it just does an excellent job of pointing out the richness of the literature and the fact that if you want to get up in front of your class and say, well, I know there's nothing to this topic because I've read a book on it, then you've said something very foolish, because there's a great deal to read. And so presenting compendia like that is another useful function of the journal.
There must be great difficulty in getting research funding through normal channels for much of this research. Is that true?
Yes, yes. In fact, this is the most serious problem, that there really is no money, except for some private foundations, to do research in any of these areas. And so many people in the society who do this in addition to their mainstream careers. It's become, I guess, in some cases, a labor of love. It's true, there is no money. And in fact, I think that's a shame, because I think that, while I realize that things are very tight, even in my own field of astronomy, I think that a certain amount of money should go to research on anything that's potentially of interest to society. For example, many of the phenomena, if they prove to be real, could well be the basis of the technology of the 21st century. We don't know that, but there are things that could ultimately benefit society if they prove to be real, and so some small amount of investment in that would certainly be useful.
How many people belong to the society, and how widespread is it? Is it just California? United States? Where?
No, it's an international society. We have members all around the world. I don't know how many different countries, but certainly the journal mails around the world. We have approximately 400 members and associates, mostly members, and as I said, the members are primarily scientists engaged in mainstream research, and associates are other people, interested people, intelligent people who want to affiliate with the society, come to the meetings, and so on.
One topic I was reading about on several occasions in the journals were about children claiming past life memories. I've read about that before. How do you do research on something like that?
Well, again, I'm not the researcher, so I can only tell you what I've myself discovered from reading the articles that appear in the journal. The researcher who has done the most on this is a medical doctor at the University of Virginia named Ian Stevenson, Professor Ian Stevenson. He's written many books on this topic, and I guess it would be fair to say he's the world's foremost expert on investigations of claims of reincarnation. He has made many trips to India, in answer to your question. He goes to India. He's interviewed thousands and thousands of people and gathered stories and statistics of children who claim that they remember this or that event from a previous life, and then he attempts to try to verify this, to see whether, in fact, he can find the individual that connects with the child's story, and to see whether there is any way that this kind of information could have been somehow given to the child by the family, if there were any normal means for this kind of information, the circumstance of the dead person to the child, to have come to the child, then he excludes that. So that's how you investigate it.
In your view, does scientific education today recognize what it means to be a scientist doing something perhaps not mainstream or not popular?
I think maybe we're a bit too glib as scientists to assume that we somehow have now acquired this mantle of truth and authority, and that history has pointed towards where we are today as really the right and only and proper way to be. Certainly science is a very noble enterprise. I mean, I think so. I do it for a living. Obviously, I have a serious commitment to science. But the presentation that we make of this being perhaps the only way to investigate reality, and that we basically have an inventory of what's real and what is not, an inventory of the laws of nature, I think that that is perhaps a mistake. I think we should keep our minds a bit more open to the possibility that we don't have an entire inventory of what is real and what isn't, and which forces are at work in the universe.
My guest today is Dr. Bernhard Heisch. He is the managing editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and he is an astrophysicist working on various NASA research projects. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. One of the topics that has been investigated several different ways in the journal has been astrology. Can you tell us some of what went on there?
Well, obviously, as an astronomer, I should at this point jump up and down and scream about...
What's your sign? Never mind.
What's my
never
sign?
Mind.
Right. Now, as an astronomer, I should have a very heated reaction to this. And in fact, I certainly don't take horoscopes seriously. But the articles that we published in the journal had to do with the investigations of a French scientist named Michel Gauquelin, and studies that sought both to replicate and to refute the conclusions that Gauquelin came to. He found a correlation between the, I believe it was the rising of Mars and the incidence of birth of major athletes. And that's about as much as I know about that, because it's not a topic that I've ever found particularly interesting nor particularly compelling. But those are the kinds of articles that we've published in astrology that certainly have nothing to do with horoscopes or anything like that.
Why does the society provide such a forum to publish such a journal?
Well, I guess I can think of four reasons that we've come up with collectively, and we've even put into a position paper, and that is to the research scientist, we commend this activity, investigation of anomalies, as a way to possibly recognize a new knowledge. To the student scientist, we point out that the way things are constructed or reconstructed in a textbook is not necessarily the way the research activity was carried out originally, and that there may well be things going on today which will make it into the history books eventually, but that you wouldn't know if you just looked at the work in mainstream science. To the public at large, I think that we owe an obligation to investigate things that certainly are of interest, but that are not adequately treated by the powers that be. And to the policymakers, we point out that some of the anomalies of today might well be the things that drive our technology 100 years from now.
All right. You wouldn't be doing this unless you had some research area. What's your research area?
No, that's not true. I really don't do any research in anomalies. In fact, it's not just a matter of lack of time, though, in fact, with all of the various things I do, mainstream and not, there certainly is a lack of time. I don't really have I don't have any research program in the anomalies. I'm really quite content as editor to sit here and to educate myself and see what other people have done. And I think perhaps it's also better because this way I can be more of a fair witness to what crosses my desk.
I saw some work being published in there on alternative medicine and therapies. Would you like to tell us some about that?
Well, as you probably know, the National Institutes of Health have just been basically ordered by Congress to set aside a certain amount of money I believe it's $2 million, which is really a very tiny fraction of the overall budget, to investigate alternative medicine. Now, we're not any part of that, really, but in fact, if papers come out of studies done by researchers funded through that program, they could well appear in our journal. And one of the people on one of the committees of this new office is a council member of the society. It's Dr. Larry Dossey. So that's a tenuous connection between us and that program. We have published an article on alternative healing. You can, in fact, do experiments to see whether healing takes place in the presence of some kind of a healer, say, versus a control group. So you can easily formulate a very simple scientific experiment around the concept of alternative healing, though you certainly wouldn't be able to investigate all the many possible claims, but you could identify some experiment that could be done in a laboratory, and those are the kinds of things that we would publish.
What areas do you see, or what topics do you see, as being sort of new topics that people are starting to look at?
I guess I would say that the investigation of alternative healing is one that will probably grow in importance. I'm not saying that it will be substantiated, but I think grow in importance as a research topic because there's tremendous public interest in it, and there's now some funding, whereas there's not any funding in other areas. There are certainly fields within mainstream science that I think are headed for some interesting developments. I think another topic that definitely is one that's not going to go away, if you're a mainstream scientist who wished all these things would simply disappear, it has to do with the topic you discussed in a program recently, the work at Princeton University, in which the possible effect of human consciousness on what are supposed to be random processes is being investigated. There is laboratory evidence coming from that work that statistically at least demonstrates that there is a phenomenon here, that the human mind somehow has an influence over things that are not supposed to be susceptible to the influence of human consciousness. I'm aware of certain classified programs that investigate anomalies. I don't know a great deal about them because I myself don't do that, but it's more than hearsay. And so I suspect that if there are results that are interesting enough for those sponsors, eventually those things will make their way into scientific investigation in the open.
There are those who say, let's not look any further. We don't understand. This is all very dangerous stuff. We know plenty. What do you think?
Well, I think nature doesn't really care what we think, you see. And whether we like it or not, if there are phenomena taking place that are not investigated by science, sooner or later science is going to have to do that because nature just insists upon being nature. I think that probing deeper and deeper into the details of things we already know is quite productive, and that's how science operates and has created tremendous technology. But I think it's a mistake to assume that we already know everything there is. People have assumed that throughout history and have always proven to be wrong.
Dr. Heisch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest today has been Dr. Bernhard Heisch. He is managing editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and he is an astrophysicist working on various NASA research projects. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for TechNation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.